Hello, sunshine.
Are you calling me sunshine?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I'm just trying to be cheery. I've had a crappy week. Oh. Bad week goes to me this week.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Katie. I've had a bad hour, also
Why?
Not related to sunshine, because I just got more wet on my bike than I thought was humanly possible.
Oh, no.
It was a typical Amsterdam downpour. So that's been my bad day, but I think you've got better reasons for why you've had a bad week, haven't you?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you've probably seen it on the news this week, listeners, but it's not been the best week to be a journalist in Paris. Actually, that's not true. It's been a really interesting week to be a journalist in Paris, but I am very tired and I had to miss my friend's wedding yesterday in Paris, which wasn't great. And yeah, I'm just really looking forward to sleeping for the rest of the week. Oh. So it's been brilliant. I'm hoping very much for an episode that's going to cheer me up.
Yeah, I think it will. I wish you were in Amsterdam because you could have come and seen the show that I did that's like really trancy and meditative. I'm doing a Gregorian chant techno opera pagan ritual experience.
Okay.
And yeah, it's really like spacey, and it would be the perfect way for you to unwind.
Oh man.
After a week of reporting on the Gilets Jaunes.
Can you give us a bit of a demo of what it's going to sound like?
No. Oh, there go the bells. Sorry. Just one second.
I can do the techno bit.
The bells want to join in.
You should use them. Incorporate them.
We should. No, yeah, you make a lovely techno beat, Katie. I am going to save the Gregorian chant for now.
Aww.
This is becoming a repetitive thing of me refusing to sing on the podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, I should just stop bullying you, really.
What have we got coming up on the show today?
Well, due to my aforementioned busyness, you have been going it alone in calling up Marta Pardavi. I'm really sorry to have missed it because she sounds like an amazing person to talk to. Marta is a prominent human rights activist in Hungary and a prime target for the increasingly authoritarian government of Viktor Orban. In a week where one of the country's best universities has been effectively kicked out of the country, we really want to hear a bit more about what it's like fighting that government. And then, on a radically different note,
this week we are also talking about sex with Paulita Papel, a feminist pornographer who lives in Berlin and is making really interesting queer pornography.
There's a first for everything, and I think it's probably the first time on this podcast I've had to say, if you listen with kids, you might want to skip that bit and go straight for the happy ending. But if you're an adult, listen away. She's great. But before all of that,
oh, I've got something for Commemoration Corner.
Sorry, I have this bad habit of skipping over Commemoration Corner. It's almost like I'm trying to kill it off. I'm not, I promise.
Yeah, why do you hate Commemoration Corner? Commemorating is important, Katie.
It's just it doesn't have a jingle yet, so I keep forgetting about it.
Can we actually get the jingle sorted, please?
Yeah, that's going to be our Christmas present from Jim. He just doesn't realise it yet.
Okay, can't wait. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
So this week we saw the 40th anniversary of the Spanish 1978 Constitution. This was like a really big step in Spain's transition to becoming a functioning democracy after the death of Franco in November 1975. Constitution Day is a public holiday in Spain, so I hope our Spanish listeners enjoyed a day off.
Yay.
But if you're like me and do a weird job, then you may not have got a day off. So I'd like to send those unlucky souls some moral support. Did you do anything Spanish to celebrate, Katie?
I talked to Paulita, who is Spanish. We should have wished her a happy Constitution anniversary.
Oh, yeah. We really should have. That was very remiss of us. But now it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
I think maybe bad week should go first because I've got kind of a lot to say. I hope you're sitting comfortably.
Go for it.
So actually, by the end of the week, there were quite a few possible candidates for bad week. The Belgian government is on the brink of collapse. The Romanian government lost its majority. But there did seem to be one person who had a particularly bad week. It's probably been the worst week of Emmanuel Macron's presidency. Just rubbish from start to finish. By now, you'll have seen pictures of burning cars in central Paris. We have had rioting of varying scales every weekend for about 3 weeks now, and protests up and down the country. And the first thing I want to say is that when you see all these pictures of cars on fire on TV and on Twitter, it looks like absolute chaos. But I just want to stress that most Parisians and people across France have been just carrying on their lives as normal, buying the baguettes, the boulangerie. This is not a revolution or anything like that. A lot of the violence was done by a really small minority of basically hooligans who just enjoy breaking things. But it is a really worrying phenomenon with really deep causes and not very obvious solutions. So I wanted to tell you all about it, really. These protesters have been turning up on the streets in their high-visibility road vests. In French, we call them gilets jaunes, literally yellow jackets. And this whole thing started in late October on Facebook as a protest movement about taxes on car petrol going up. So gas, as our Americanists would call it. Basically, the price of gas went up this year, mostly because oil prices have been going up around the world. But at the same time, Macron has also been increasing taxes on petrol and diesel over the past year, and he was going to do it again in January.
So is the justification for raising fuel, is it simply environmental, or is it also just trying to fill a hole in the budget?
No, I think it was mostly environmental. Macron has, at least on the world stage, been doing this whole kind of, I want to save the planet thing and make the world great again, all that kind of stuff. And it is, I think, part of a genuine effort to try and make the French economy less dependent on fossil fuels.
But it's not gone down well, the fact that he's getting the ordinary people to do the hard work and letting business get away with it. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic example of the poor having to bear the brunt of a policy that is designed to help, like, all of us, effectively. The idea behind it is it's supposed to encourage people to drive less and take public transport more because it would make driving a car more expensive. And as we all know, cars aren't great for pollution. But for people who live in the countryside, they were like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, we have to get around by car. This is going to add a massive amount onto our monthly outgoings. And like, we don't even have public transport or like much public transport out here. Are you mad? So this whole thing started as a protest about the cost of driving, but it's really quickly become this very big movement against Macron in general. And this idea among protesters that he and his government basically understand nothing about how ordinary people live in provincial France. Macron is, of course, a former investment banker. And while he calls himself a centrist, if you look at the policies that he's introduced over the past year, there's a few things that back up this really widespread criticism of him that he is what we call in France a président des riches, literally a president of the rich. So they say that he only looks out for rich people in France. He doesn't look out for working class people. He doesn't look out for lower middle class people. So one thing he's done, which is super unpopular among the protesters, is he's got rid of this wealth tax on France's richest people, which he argued is the right thing to do, because if you let rich people keep more of their money, they'll invest it rather than moving it to like offshore bank accounts. Mm. And that will create jobs and boost the whole of the French economy. First of all, that hasn't really paid off amazingly well so far. We've still got 9.3% unemployment. So people are like, where are all these jobs you promised us? And secondly, more generally, when people see Macron cutting taxes for the richest people, while at the same time he's been trimming housing allowances and raising taxes on pensioners, it's not a great look. And then there's a bunch of comments that he's made, which we've talked about before on this podcast, which have basically come off sounding really dismissive of poor people. Like the thing with the gardener, where he was basically like, I could get you a job if I just cross the road, and making out that this guy was like a massive slacker. There's a really big personal dislike of Macron. Do you have any questions? I feel like I've been talking for hours.
No, it's actually really interesting. I've been kind of not following the story that intensely, so I'm quite interested to hear a good summary of it. But do you know how unequal France is compared to other European countries? Because I get the impression that, like, actually France is a very poor country other than the elite living in Paris and in the Riviera.
Yeah, one thing that's quite interesting is how many French people earn the minimum wage. It's pretty high. It's about 10% of people. Whereas in the US, just to give one comparison, it's about 2.3% of people that get paid by the hour.
And the minimum wage is actually quite low in France, isn't it?
It's €9.88, which is, I think, one of the higher rates in Europe. But the problem is that France also has like some of the highest tax bills in Europe. So it's take-home pay. People feel like they don't get much take-home pay.
The good thing about France is that they have quite a good welfare state, don't they? So things that maybe aren't covered in some other countries are covered there, but then people aren't left with much disposable income.
Exactly. So the health system is good. The education is paid for. It's just that people feel that after all of that and after taxes, they don't really have that much to play with.
So then getting a fuel tax rise is really annoying.
Yeah, that's largely what the Gilets Jaunes movement is about. It's about rising living costs, and it's about not having enough money, and it is about not feeling like you're understood by the government. But because that's a pretty broad complaint, it's kind of expanded to cover people that have all kinds of different aims, some of them pretty contradictory, some of them a bit wacky. I've been spending a lot of time this week combing through their Facebook groups, which are absolutely massive, like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of members. And you'll find a lot of people in there just saying generic things like, we hate Macron. But you'll also find people saying that the world is run by Freemasons. And
it is. Oh. I've been saying that for ages. Kidding.
We maybe need to start a new podcast about that. But yeah, it's really diverse. There are far right people in there. There are far left people in there. There are people that want to get rid of parliamentary democracy altogether and like just have referendums on the internet. So it's this weird kind of assembly of ordinary people struggling to get by on the take-home pay. And there's some fringe oddballs in there as well, which makes them really difficult to negotiate with because they want different things.
But they've actually been like amazingly successful with these protests, haven't they? In terms of reversing the policy. And it was only actually a few thousand people protesting, wasn't it?
No, I mean, it's across the country. Yesterday, nationwide, 136,000 people turned out at different protests, which is about the same as a week earlier. Like, it's not showing any sign of dying down.
Why did I read that it was only 8,000 in Paris?
There were. Actually, the final figures were 10,000, which is actually a bit crazy because at the same time, there was this climate march in Paris, which had probably, the organisers think, 25,000 people. And people just didn't end up talking about it, which is pretty sad.
Yeah, I was going to say, it didn't sound, with these protests being like so focused on Paris, at least in the news. And yes, it's violent, so that's why it's in the news. But that's not a very big number of people.
But I mean, around the country, 136,000, I mean, it's a fair amount of people.
Okay, that is a big number of people. I didn't know that. Sorry.
That's all right. They have actually managed to get quite a lot out of Macron already. So last week, he offered them a whole bunch of stuff, billions of euros worth of benefits designed to help low-income families. And crucially, he agreed to scrap the rises in the gas and diesel taxes, which had made people so pissed off in the first place, which is a massive turnaround for this president that had previously been like, I'm not going to be like previous presidents and be pushed around by people turning out on the streets, which is a thing in France, you might have noticed. So he made some big concessions already. But it didn't stop people coming out on the streets this weekend anyway. A lot of them want Macron to resign, which isn't going to happen. But they are looking for some kind of big gesture from him. We're recording this on Sunday. It's possible that by the time this goes out on Tuesday, he would have offered them something acceptable. But at this point, I can't tell you what that is.
I hope you get to leave the office sometime soon, Katie.
Thank you. So do I. One day it may happen. But anyway, who's had a bad week?
Good week.
Good week. I'm tired.
It has been a good week for the people of Luxembourg after an announcement from the government that from next summer, all public transport in the entire country is going to be free.
Woohoo!
That's trains, buses, trams, the full shebang. They will be the first country in the world to have free public transport across the board, across the country.
Wow.
This is a policy from the coalition government led by Prime Minister Xavier Bettel, who took office for his second term last week and has placed environmental policy at the centre of his programme. Other policies in consideration include legalising cannabis and adding two extra public holidays. So things could be looking very good for Luxembourgers.
That sounds like a kind of progressive populist platform. It's like all the stuff that progressive people like, give it to them.
Holidays and weed.
Love that stuff.
How are they paying for the free transport? Well, they'll be saving on the ticket inspectors and the ticket machines. So actually, it's a bad week for ticket inspectors. Sorry. And they're going to be ending a tax break for commuters to cover some of the rest of it. There are other details that still need working out, such as what to do with the first and second class carriages. But it looks like it'll go through Parliament. And I think it's very good news. Can you remember any Luxembourgish from our episode with Nina Lamparsky back in January, Katie?
I can remember the English version of a quite offensive tongue twister.
Oh, was it about potatoes?
No, not the one about potatoes, the other one. That's like, if your fat kid calls our fat kid fat one more time, then our fat kid will call your fat kid fat until he doesn't call him fat anymore or something like that. We need to get Nina to give us a refresher course, I think.
Or maybe we should never mention that tongue twister ever again.
Or maybe not.
Anyway, I looked it up on Google Translate and apparently good week in Luxembourgish is good Woche. So, good Woche, Luxembourg. There has been more very concerning news from Hungary this week. The Central European University has announced that after 2 years of legal and rhetorical wrangling with Orbán's government, it has decided that it has no option but to move out of Budapest. CEU is a university dedicated to liberal principles and founded by the arch-enemy of Viktor Orbán, George Soros. Orbán is looking more and more like an authoritarian as each day goes by, and whilst the university will continue to function in Vienna and with some select courses still going on in Budapest, it is certainly a very sad thing to see a respected university being pushed out of an EU country. I took some time earlier this week. What?
The weight of that sigh. The whole Hungarian current state of affairs was summed up in that sigh.
Yeah, and actually, I shouldn't be sighing when people like Marta, who we're about to speak to, is like spending her life fighting Orban. And I bet she doesn't sigh all the time.
Although it must be pretty exhausting for her just fighting all the time. Like, what is it like fighting on a daily basis against a government that is doing this, that is behaving in this really worrying way and like trying to dismantle civil society, basically? I'm really sorry that I wasn't here to join you for this interview, Dominic.
Yeah, you've been pretty busy in France this week.
There's been some stuff.
So Marta is the co-chair of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, which is a non-governmental watchdog that protects human dignity and the rule of law through legal and public advocacy methods. She's on this like incredibly stressful front line of resistance to Viktor Orban, and we thought she was the perfect person to call up to get some reaction to the news about CEU and to find out what it's like fighting with Viktor Orban week to week. We hear a steady stream of really alarming reports from Hungary, particularly around the erosion of democratic institutions. I imagine it's changed your life and work significantly since Orban came to power in 2010. But could you give us an idea of how life has changed for normal people living in Hungary over these 8 years?
I think even for people who've lost interest or never were interested in what's going on, you know, in the Hungarian parliament, do see an impact. Most newspapers available on the market would carry news that very much resonate the government's position. And you would see lots of government-funded advertising too. That advertising would send you messages about sinister forces such as George Soros wanting to bring invaders, Muslim invaders, to the country. And so even if you're not following politics, you can't escape it. It seeps in to every nook of your life. That is, I think, something that is pretty repulsive. And lots of people are absolutely, of course, influenced by that. We see how, since early 2015, this kind of publicly funded, taxpayer-funded government advertising campaigns have really changed how Hungarians see some issues.
Do any of the scandals that we hear about in Western Europe, do any of them cut through to the general public in Hungary, anything that's critical of Orban, or is it just a complete whitewashing?
No, of course it does cut through, and there's a lot of talk about corruption scandals where family members or government officials or friends of Mr. Orban are regularly written about having made fortunes from unknown sources or sources which are clearly demonstrated not to be lawful. So there's lots of stories about corruption, about crumbling healthcare, about public education. You find this, but in the print media, it is increasingly hard to find news of this. And in the traditional broadcast media, there's also an increasingly sort of shrinking space for this kind of discontent, even though it does exist. So an ordinary person who does not consume internet-based online news will have much less of a chance of hearing about this. And this is absolutely because of a significant change in the media landscape where independent media outlets have over time, many of them turned into government mouthpieces through changing ownership, or where the owners have decided to close down media outlets as a response to political pressure.
Was there much reporting about the forced withdrawal of Central European University this week?
This is actually a very sad issue in and of itself, but also very symptomatic of where Hungary is at the moment or where it could be heading. This is something that is portrayed as, for many people, as a huge restriction of academic freedom. But for many people who have never heard of CU before, who only consume news from this government influence or funded media, they believe that CU is sort of an ideological place where people are prepped to basically become enemies of the Hungarian government. It's a fake university, it's a Soros university. So it is a complete misrepresentation of the excellence, really. But I think many Hungarians believe that this is sort of a breeding ground for liberals and they think that it's best if it doesn't exist in Hungary and can't wait to have it moved to Vienna. This, I think, is probably a minority opinion, but it is a strong one, and it is very much pushed by a lot of opinion pieces in this pro-government media.
I wanted to know how much of an emotional toll it has been over the last 8 years on you, like constantly fighting this government that maybe doesn't even want organizations like yours to exist.
For us at the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, we had to start seeing that, if not before, then in early 2015, when all of a sudden one of our core areas of work, which is helping asylum seekers in asylum procedures with giving legal information and legal representation, so basically helping refugees gain protection status, this became a number one political item, and all of a sudden we started hearing our work described as something that needs to be basically done away with. Ever since then, I think there's a series of news where you find yourself sort of watching or reading with disbelief. You can't imagine this happening, but it does happen. And so in a way, I think you cannot get used to it, but you still do. And you say, okay, so this is the latest development. This is what we will be having to tackle. You see many Hungarians protesting in the street. Thousands and thousands of people stood up for CU and for civil society. You see political allies of Mr. Orbán's party speaking out against these attacks on academic scientific freedom. You see the European institutions, and still the Hungarian government goes ahead. This is really hard to take. Whether this is making you more resilient in a way, or whether it slowly erodes people's commitment is a big question. And I see both. I really see both. But interesting how for many, I think this actually pushes them to be more active, be more committed, be more outspoken, and to be able to face themselves in the mirror every morning. But also I've heard people say, the reason I do this, the reason I'm still, you know, working in the human rights sector, the reason I'm still working as a journalist uncovering these stories, the reason I go out in the street to protest is because I want to be able to answer to my children in 20 years when they ask, what did you do? Where were you when democracy was being demolished? Did you sit at home? We are doing our best and we must continue to do this.
And I think you do have some victories against the government to your name, don't you? I was wondering whether you could tell us a bit about a success that you've had.
Yes. What is achievement is, of course, very relative nowadays. But I think we do a lot of legal work. So we use the law to fight this authoritarian trend and injustices that people face. We have people coming to us, to our office, writing us, calling us. We give free legal advice, but we also take on cases increasingly where people are being retaliated against because of having different views, different from the government's position. So we have had a good series of successes about this. For example, a labor lawsuit for a woman who was fired because she actually protected a colleague who had a Facebook post that was critical of the government. It is so upsetting that this is happening. You know, it's 2018. How can people be fired for either making a government critical Facebook post or for standing up for somebody's free speech rights? And so we took on this case and it had huge media attention and we won. One other type of victory, refugee protection. This is happening in a country where the Hungarian government does not even acknowledge basically that there could be refugees in Hungary. It only talks about migrants or illegal migrants, and we continue to talk about people who are fleeing war and need protection and reach Europe as people and who need to be given proper access to procedures, to treatment, to shelter. Whether this can turn government policy around is a big question. For the short term, I don't see that happening. But the mere fact that there are still people who agree with this is a big achievement in Hungary, where you have government propaganda against refugees basically everywhere.
Now it's time for an awkward segue.
Yeah, I feel like we need a kind of gear change sound effect just to ram home just how different this interview is. We're going from authoritarianism in Hungary to feminist pornography. Paulita Papel. She is a Spanish pornographer living in Berlin, and she makes ethical porn. She performs in it. She works behind the camera. She curates a porn festival in Berlin. She's just super positive about the whole thing, which I think is a very fresh and much needed perspective on the industry and something that we don't really talk about very much. So we thought we'd give her a ring. The first thing I'm super interested in is to hear about your career route. I mean, how did you get into this line of work in the first place?
So I've always been fascinated by porn, although I have to say that I never really watched it. I was more interested in the idea. I was always very conflicted because I grew up thinking that porn was exploitative to women, that it was a tool of the patriarchy. And then when I discovered third wave feminism or sex positive feminism and met a bunch of queer feminists here in Berlin that were doing their own porn, I was like, yay, I can do porn and still be a feminist. So basically I started in a very DIY scene. So it was no money involved. We only did it for the politics because we believed that there was a necessity to show our own bodies, our own desires, our own sexuality. And then after a while I realized, you know, you can also earn money from it, which is not a bad thing. And I kept working as a performer. I was always very privileged. I could choose very carefully with whom I'd like to work and my conditions. I also work as a film producer, so I started to work more behind the camera. And 3 years ago, the idea of Lustry came up, which is a platform, you know, where real couples shoot themselves in the intimacy of their own houses and upload their videos. And that for me, since I was very interested in trying to find a way how pornography can be the closest as possible to documenting sexuality more than fictionalizing, that felt like the right thing to do, and that's what I've been mostly doing for the last 3 years.
So you say you live in Berlin. I feel like Berlin seems to be quite a hub for this kind of new wave of ethical and queer porn as well. Is my idea right? Is it a center of queer porn and ethical porn?
Absolutely, I think so. I think a lot of people that are just, you know, dissident in either in their gender identities or sexualities do come to Berlin because Berlin is generally a very sex-positive city. So there's a lot of sex clubs and, you know, a lot of people talking about sex, doing sex and so on and so forth, a huge BDSM scene, a huge queer scene, which always nurtures so much of body politics and this kind of, and fosters this kind of conversation. And so in this atmosphere, there is also a very important, big, very quite DIY ethical feminist porn scene. There's some people getting themselves together and trying to organize a porn performers association, and there's really a lot of dialogue and a lot of things happening here.
You talk about feminist porn.
Mm-hmm.
What is the problem with most of the porn that you can find on the internet? And like, what is the difference between that and what you're trying to do?
See, it's a very interesting question, but I always like to question this question when I get it asked, because I get it asked a lot of times, because it creates a duality between like the mainstream porn and like alternative porn or the porn that I do. And I don't like to create that binary thinking because it sounds like what's bad and what's good. And I actually do not think that there's really anything wrong with porn per se. Like there's a problem with society and the way maybe we consume it and the way we have access to it and the way it's distributed. Mm-hmm. What I do is I try to document a reality. I want to believe that I'm capturing intimacy and real connections between people, but I wouldn't say that that's better or worse than any other kind of porn.
Can we talk for a second about the economics of it? Because there's a huge amount of free porn on the internet, much of it there illegally. Is that something you have to struggle with as a pornographer, making the ethical feminist porn that you make, or is it mainly mainstream porn that ends up for free online?
Both. I mean, it is, our content gets constantly pirated, and that's a problem. We invest a lot of energy, time, and money in trying to protect our content. That is enabled because we live in a society that does not care for porn. Like, porn is considered something dirty, something that, you know, one does in private but doesn't talk about it. It's not acknowledged as an entertaining product. So, say, for all other industries, like the music industry, the film industry, there's a lot of measures in place to try and protect that content that also gets pirated. For porn, nobody cares, right? And that's why also a lot of people, you know, you will find it in a lot of like forums and messages. People are like, why pay for your porn? Low, it's for free. that's why we're so helpless against these platforms, because there's nothing to do. But I think the bigger problem is not so much piracy, because, again, it's in a time of internet, everything is going to get pirated. But it's the stigma that people in general in society have against porn. The biggest challenges that I encounter as running an adult company is that I cannot use any of the usual services that any other company would use. So say for money, I can't use PayPal because they don't accept adult industry. Or, you know, web hosting, opening a bank account. There's a lot of things that we cannot use just because we're adult industry.
Which is so crazy because, like, there's billions of people around the world that consume this product.
Right.
We just don't talk about it like it's any other industry. It's,
yeah.
It's pure sex negativity and discrimination.
But surely that's illegal. Surely these companies shouldn't be able to discriminate against you in that way.
I wish. Please say it out loud. No, it's not legal in all countries, obviously. I mean, not in Europe and definitely not in the world. And there, like on the contrary, there's very severe laws against adult companies in a lot of places. And it's completely, I'm going to say, normal, like, for a lot of institutions, especially state institutions, to actually in their guidelines, say for example, film funding in Germany, in their guidelines, it says explicitly, we will never give money to projects that are either promoting violence or pornographic. So they're just like, you know, putting us in that box, which is like completely random and just absurd.
I know you don't like talking about sort of like, you know, what's wrong with porn or kind of like talking about it negatively like that. But in terms of sort of best practice, if I was to go out and make a porn film, what are some kind of basic principles that you try and abide by? Or like, what do you think makes a porn film good and ethical?
Big keyword, consent. Before the shooting, complete transparency and good communication between everyone involved, especially the performers, of course, but also the crew. Clear contracts, clear settings, you know, what are we agreeing on, what's going to happen, STD testing, creating a very safe work environment. Then during the shoot, again, consent at all times, like giving the performers and everyone else a space to express how they're doing. If there's any difficulty, like try to deal with it in the best way possible. And again, after the shooting, same thing, always make clear and transparent where the content is going to go. Consent, consent, consent.
Yeah. So my happy ending, the title happy ending feels particularly filled with innuendo today, following that interview.
Not for the first time.
But yeah, my happy ending this week is on the border of being like a happy ending and a public service announcement.
Okay.
I discovered this week that choosing to buy wine with a cork instead of a screw cap can help defeat climate change.
Ooh.
I don't think that it's going to do the job alone, but it turns out that harvesting cork trees makes the trees 3 to 5 times more effective at absorbing CO2 than unharvested cork trees. So we need to drink more wine, Katie.
I mean, that's not a problem. I feel like I'm kind of putting my weight already. But yeah, the more incentives, the merrier.
So do you want to hear a bit about the process?
Yeah.
It's quite complicated, but it's also really fascinating. And yeah, the reason why I found out about this corky environmental trick is because Euronews have created a really nice immersive story looking at the production line at a cork factory in Girona.
Ooh.
Check it out. You'll find it on our Twitter feed at EuropeansPod. But the cork oak is an amazing plant. In general, it transports water effectively through its roots, and each tree can sustain around 100 species. Cork forests are in fact thought of as some of the top biodiversity hotspots in the whole of Europe. Other advantages are that they provide great rural employment, and as if they weren't like total heroes already, these trees are more fire resistant than most trees due to their thick bark.
Huh.
So we really need to start drinking wine with real corks again, because it's just great all round for biodiversity, for employment, and for the climate. There is of course a slight risk with real corks that the bottle will be spoiled, but take that risk and go back to buying cork. No more screw tops. Corks are magical.
And I also kind of think like corks are kind of classier, although I think that isn't actually true, is it? It's not necessarily like fancier wine just because it's got a cork in it. But do you want to know something a little bit embarrassing?
Go on.
I didn't really know what a cork tree was before you started talking. And in my head, while you were talking, I just had this image of like loads of corks dangling off a tree, like, you know, kind of like on an Australian hat.
Yes.
That's not what it looks like. It just looks like a tree. I've learned so many things. Thank you, Dominic.
That's okay. Well, you should definitely watch this immersive video on your own news then, because you need to know where corks come from.
I have a lot to learn.
And it involves a lady who sits at the end looking at all the corks as they come by her really quickly and picking out the bad ones.
Ooh.
I was like totally obsessed with watching it for a few minutes. I couldn't stop watching her just like cleverly pick out the ones that were rotten.
What happens to all the rotten ones, I wonder?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe they did say. No, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that, I'm afraid. So we better just end the podcast there.
Okay, bye.
Bye.